Welcome to the Empathy Edge podcast, the show that proves why cash flow, creativity, and compassion are not mutually exclusive. I'm your host, Maria Ross. I'm a speaker, author, mom, facilitator, and empathy advocate. And here you'll meet trailblazing leaders and executives, authors, and experts who embrace empathy to achieve radical success. We discuss all facets of empathy, from trends and research to the future of work, to how to heal societal divisions and collaborate more effectively. Our goal is to redefine success and prove that empathy isn't just good for society, it's great for business. In the world of corporate risk, what is often viewed as the weakest link? That's right, people. This can often be why leaders fear letting go of control and create rigid rules that may not work for everyone or actually hinder resilience. But that means that if you have the right people leaders with the right skills, your people can also be your greatest defense to combat the wide variety of security challenges that exist today and nimbly adapt to changing conditions. My guest today shares why empathy, agility, and resilience are actually vital to managing risk and keeping your organization secure. Steve Durbin is the chief executive of the Information Security Forum, or ISF, and a leading expert in cybersecurity, strategy, and emerging threats in both corporate and personal environments. He hosts the ISF podcast and is a frequent speaker on technology and security issues. Formerly at Ernst & Young and Gartner, he has advised global tech companies on IPOs, M&As, and security strategies. Recognized as a top influencer in information security, Steve is a Forbes Business Council member, a lecturer at Henley Business School, and a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Marketing. Today, Steve shares the biggest threats to organizations right now and how empathetic leaders foster the resiliency needed to adapt. We discuss how CISOs and risk officers can create an empathetic culture where trust and transparency flows to help protect the organization. Steve shares how letting go of control can actually keep you safer, and how curiosity and listening helps you communicate in ways people understand. He candidly shares that CEOs who don't understand empathy are a risk. And finally, Steve offers ways to balance a culture of experimentation and empowerment with effective risk management. This is an eye-opening conversation to all my data-driven, technology-driven folks out there who think empathy has no place. Take a listen. Welcome, Steve, to the Empathy Edge podcast. I am very excited to talk to you today about the state of risk and global influence on leadership and on organizations today from your specific vantage point. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Maria. Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So before we dive in to talking about all the things and how management of information and management of people can help us live with and manage through the risk that we face today, tell us a little bit about your story and how you got into this work. You know, you are now chief executive of the Information Security Forum. But how did you get here and what are you most passionate about?
Yeah, I never set out to work in security. I didn't really know much about it, to be quite honest. I came to security, I was at EY. I was doing a lot of M&A work, working with a lot of entrepreneurs, sort of startups, that kind of thing, fast growth organizations. And one day I was approached about joining the ISF, and I'd never heard of them and I'd never really come across security at all, which is interesting. If you think about the amount of M&A work that goes on, not to have even considered the role of security would seem perhaps strange today, but mm-hmm. going back, I don't know, 15, 16 years, it was the norm. And so I was intrigued, and it was really sort of presented to me as more of an opportunity to grow an organization. So the security bit wasn't really overplayed. And that was how it all started. And, you know, here we are, 16, 17 years on. Mm-hmm. I'm still here. And the security space keeps changing. It's very, very fast moving. It is, in its own way, very entrepreneurial. It's going mm-hmm. to become increasingly so as well when we see things like AI coming in and the different ways in which people are going to have to respond to that. Mm-hmm. But there was no sort of master plan. There was no sort of, you know, wake
there never
up,
is.
Jump out of bed and say, you know, that's it, security. That's the thing for me.
Yeah.
Because I started out in literature.
Really?
Literature. That was my degree. Yeah.
That is really interesting.
And then worked in technology from there and, mm-hmm. you know, consultancy, and then ended up where I am today. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, I think that also gives you a more holistic view of things. I think when you have people just that are in single silos and single tracks approaching their work, sometimes that causes us to not see risks or not see opportunities because we're so single-minded. So I really appreciate that you have kind of this well-rounded background and you're coming at it from that perspective. So let's dive into security, because it's really interesting to me. Obviously, we're in a time of disruption. We've got cybersecurity threats. We've got AI. We've got geopolitical forces impacting organizations. Leaders are dealing with a lot. And so what do you think are the biggest threats right now? Not only from a security perspective, but from an organizational perspective, where do you think CEOs and C-suite leaders need to focus right now in terms of the threats that are out there to their organization?
Yeah, I think, you know, many people at this point will probably expect me to dive into technology, and I don't see it that way at all, actually. I see it as being fairly and squarely in that sort of people wheelhouse. And the reason that I say that is twofold. First, when things go wrong, it is people who dig you out. We can pretend that we've got the best technology in the world, that we've got all the great backups, but I'm not aware of any organization that has gone through a significant breach or significant downtime that has said, okay, you know, feet up, let's go, we'll go down the coffee shop because technology is going to get it all working for us. It doesn't work like that. It's people who have to do it. And then on the flip side, then people are often, you know, viewed as being the weakest link in the security chain and get a bad rep from being that. And it's true that a lot of, you know, phishing, malware, all of those sorts of things come in because people click on the wrong links. And mm-hmm. But that's human nature. So I think, you know, when you go into the boardroom, it's all too easy to get involved in a conversation around ChatGPT and AI. And, you know, and I've been there and I've had those conversations because it's the latest shiny new toy. Mm-hmm. But people are at the heart of it. If you step away from that, and what are the sorts of things that we need to be concerned about? Well, geopolitics is up there. You know, mm-hmm. it's fairly and squarely right at the top of the list. The rise in cybercrime, obviously, whether that be state-sponsored or whether it be otherwise, that's up there as well. And mm-hmm. most boards are concerned about ransomware mm-hmm. and what they ought to do about that, how they're going to respond to it. So those are the sorts of things from a security standpoint. But ultimately, you know, when an organization assesses risk, it's in the context of what it's trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, is it trying to expand? Is it trying to introduce new products and all of those sorts of things? And again, I've noticed that sometimes the security component, the risk component, can get lost in some of the enthusiasm that you would hope is sparked. Yeah. By an organization wanting to do something fresh, new, different.
Right.
But those are the sorts of things that we're talking about mostly at the moment, and the sorts of things that organizations are concerned about.
So much to dive into there. I want to talk a little bit, and obviously why you're here is because people are at the heart of both the risk and the opportunity and solution around what we're facing right now. Yeah. But I want to talk a little bit about that. So when you're working with clients or you're working with other organizations and leaders, what are the types of skills that are required from our people now to really be able to handle these risks and be able to meet the moment and adapt to what's coming at us?
Yeah. You know, again, if you look at it through the security lens and just go back not that many years, and actually you still see it today. When people are advertising for, say, a chief information security officer, you know, they want somebody who's in their 30s with 40 years experience, you know, completely unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
The reality of the matter, I would say, is what you're looking for is people who are naturally curious, people who are able to bring different elements of the business to the risk challenge, who are going to be able to contextualize it, ground it, convey the risk in a language that people not just understand, but buy into. Because ultimately, of course, what you're trying to do when you identify a risk of some sort is to put in place some kind of mitigation. Mm-hmm. Whether that be a plan for the day that you hope never comes, or whether it be a real, you know, mitigation plan for something that needs to be addressed in the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
Inevitably, you're going to have to sell that message to somebody, and you're going to have to support them through the implementation of whatever that project or plan happens to look like.
Mm-hmm.
So if you struggle stringing two words together, you're going to be up against it. And again, that's stating the bleeding obvious. But so often I see organizations still, you know, trying to entrust some fairly sophisticated people interactions to people that are probably best suited to really working with the machines, working with the technology, doing all of the great things that needs to be done in that space.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about really understanding, I think, who is best placed to deal with the challenge, the issue that you have, and making sure that you've got your best players on the field at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, I suppose the biggest job of any senior executive. Mm-hmm. It always makes me smile, because if you talk to anybody who's, you know, going through the career, going up the career ladder, they'll always say they want to manage people. Now, that seems to be the whole sort of goal, doesn't it? You know, I want to manage people. I've really arrived when I manage people. And it's interesting, you know, you talk to some of them after they've been doing that for a short while, and they wish they'd never started, because people are just hugely difficult to manage.
Yeah.
And if you get it right, it's immensely rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it has its ups and downs.
Well, I think, you know, we talk a lot on the show on the difference between management and leadership. And managers really manage tasks. Leaders can empower people.
Right.
And I love, of course, I love what you're saying, because that's why you're on the show. But it's this idea of being a leader who can listen. Curiosity, the number one trait of empathic leaders, the number one trait of empathic people, is your ability to put your ego aside and listen and understand that there might be a different perspective. There might be a different point of view. And this is really that, you know, what you're saying is really that tie-in and making that business case for diversity and inclusion. Because when we have people with different points of view, we might see risks we would have missed, or we might uncover opportunities that we overlooked, because people have a different vantage point. And so being a leader, well, I love what you're saying about this idea of being a leader who can listen, who can be curious, but also to your other point, this is speaking straight to my brand strategist heart, is the ability to articulate that message. And this is why clarity is actually an element and a marker of empathy. When you can really be clear with someone, you can hold someone accountable to an expectation that you've clearly set. And to your point, being able to clearly articulate the risk, being able to clearly articulate the mitigation strategy and get people's buy-in is so crucial. And we tend to skip that when we're hiring for the resume or we're hiring for the university somebody attended. We really need to be a little bit better in the hiring process of looking at a leader in terms of how do they interact with people, because that's where the empathy comes in. And that's where, you know, it's confident empathy. It's not strong empathy, but it's this idea that I can actually listen and I can adapt to the people in front of me based on their needs and based on how they can best receive a message. So I love that you're saying this.
You know, Maria, I think you're absolutely spot on. You know, for me, the best leaders understand that they need to explain the why. Why does somebody have to do something?
Mm-hmm.
And all too often, I think, you come across some leaders who perhaps have forgotten that that's what their role is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you sort of veer towards the dictator leader, the sort of command and control leader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has its place. And from time to time, we will all, you know, flip into that because mm-hmm. that's appropriate for that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that increasingly, and this is very, very true in the security space, you know, we talk so much in security about the need for increased awareness. Well, you increase awareness by explaining why people need to be aware.
Yeah, why they should care.
Exactly. And you have to make it personal.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, this isn't some sort of, you know, fluffy leadership It's actually exceptionally practical, efficient, yes, and has been shown to work. Mm-hmm. And that is the message, I think, that sometimes it's very easy to lose sight of, mm-hmm. you know, as you sort of, you know, elevate to the dizzy heights of running mm-hmm. an organization, you know, you forget right. you actually need to put people around you as well who are just going to nudge you and remind you
right.
of why you're there. Yeah, and that's hugely important.
Yeah. I mean, in my most recent book, The Empathy Dilemma, when I talk about the five pillars of being both an effective and an empathetic leader, within clarity is a tactic of building a culture of why, being able to explain to people. It's not coddling. It's not, you know, I laugh when I hear these leaders say like, well, I just need to tell them what to do and they should just do it, you know? Yes. And if you want your mm-hmm. people running at full capacity and optimize their contribution to what you're doing, give them a reason why. This is why purpose-driven organizations do so well, is because you're giving people a reason to perform, a reason to innovate, a reason to think about it, and a reason to accept, even if it's a decision they don't like or agree with. You're at least giving them a reason to say, okay, I don't really agree with it, but I kind of get it. I understand why we need to do this and why it's important. And that, you know, follow the data, follow the research on that boosts engagement and performance and innovation and all of those things within a culture. But I love your perspective because, you know, a lot of what I talk about is related to how empathy is practical within the workplace and how it actually enhances the bottom line. And, you know, nothing to me is more practical than security and risk. There's nothing more sort of data-driven and analytical to me as a very right brain thinker. So I love that you're tying this to the importance of if you want to manage and mitigate risk effectively, it still has to come down to your people. And you said something earlier that I kind of chuckled at inside because I do a lot of talks now around the role of empathetic leadership in the age of AI. Mm-hmm. And you talked about, you know, it's not the machine or the algorithm that's going to solve your security problem or that's going to solve your risk problem. It's your people. So as you're working with leaders now, how are you finding their reception to that message? Do they get it? Do some of them still need to kind of connect the dots around the fact that they do need to be more of a people-centered leader in order to mitigate risk and to keep their organization secure? What's sort of the consensus you're finding within the executives that you talk to?
I think the consensus is that people are finding it really tough. Mm-hmm. You know, the world is not in a great place. There is a need for increased agility from an organization to be able to respond to things that change on a very, very regular basis, you know, whether that be the implementation of tariffs, whether it be the outbreak of war, whether it be the implications that conflict might have on the supply chain, whether it may be a whole range of different things that are, you know, hitting leaders and their businesses. And yes, you know, particularly the C-suite, the board, obviously they have to continue to meet the expectations of the stakeholders, the shareholders, the employees. Mm-hmm. So it's an immensely stressful time at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so I think that even the best, the leaders that get it the most when it comes to the need for some of these things we're talking about, even they are going to fall off the wagon from time to time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay. I think one of the most difficult things that a leader has to do is to allow himself or herself the space to get it wrong. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you get it wrong. What's important is how you make it right. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the sort of the dawning realization mm-hmm. that we're starting to see with some fairly advanced thinkers in that space. But there are so many different elements to consider, you know, because if you're a fairly traditional organization, maybe family run, always behaved in a certain way, you know, my way or the highway, you know, then bringing in some of these concepts are perhaps a little alien. Much easier, perhaps, if you're entrepreneurial, fast growth startup, because you don't have any baggage.
Right.
I think it's really interesting to see. And you've probably done this, you know, to sort of categorize, not in a destructive way, but to categorize some of the leaders that we're seeing at the moment who are dealing with just the post-pandemic, you mm-hmm. know, this shift from perhaps, well, you could all work at home, now you all need to work in the office, And, you know, there doesn't seem to be a massive amount of halfway house in some of these things.
Right.
And again, for me, I think these are not some of the issues. The issues should be, what is in the best interest of providing the service, the product to the client base? How are you going to get the best from your employees in doing that? Mm-hmm. And then let's worry about whether or not they ought to be in one big multi-story building
right.
or spread around the world.
Right.
And I think all too often that piece sometimes mm-hmm. is missed because we can become so dogmatic about it, you know, and people, mm-hmm. being people, will always want to know why it is that Susan can work from home while Thelma has to go into the office.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of this sort of thing. And you can get caught up
yes. in
meaningless debate. Whereas if you go back to the why, you know, mm-hmm. why it's important for people to work collectively together, you know, is that the best way of doing it? And if so, mm-hmm. well, for how long? Then actually this discussion about whether or not I have to go into work or work from mm-hmm. home, I find tends to go away.
Of course.
Just yeah. one example that I've observed.
Yeah. I mean, I call this the snap back to bossism post-pandemic. It's like some leaders who are saying, you had your fun being treated like humans, now it's time to get back to work. And I believe a lot of that is from fear. I do a lot of talks and a lot of advising around this. It's that it's the companies, I've had folks on my show where it's the companies that have an experimental mindset of work has changed. We're not going back. People have seen what they've been capable of doing in a different work structure. Ooh. And we're not going back. So instead of fighting it because our leaders are just too scared or don't trust their people enough, if they're not, they can't see them for the entire workday and have them all within the same four walls. Let's experiment with different ways of doing this. And let's, because nobody has it figured out. I spoke to the CHRO of Box, and they're doing a lot of experimentation around this. And they're like, she said, you know, show me someone who actually has this on lock, who understands what they're doing. We're all learning as we go. And we have to have that experimental mindset of, we tried it this way. Here's what went well. Here's what didn't. We listened to our employees. We measured productivity. We measured sentiment, you know, and they're constantly tweaking and tuning to see where they can land on this versus a leader who's just like, I don't want to learn how to lead in a new way. I want to go back to the way things were because that's where I'm comfortable. And so everybody needs to be back in the office, even if it doesn't necessarily make sense. And so, you know, talk about risk, you risk losing your best people if you're not willing to sort of adapt to how things need to get done. But I love the way you narrowed it down. And this is what I try to always get them to think about, is what is going to be best for the organization and our customers or clients or whoever our constituents and stakeholders are. That's what it comes down to. And if we have leaders who are unsure or afraid of leading in a hybrid environment or a remote environment, we need to upskill them. Like, to me, you know, again, you and me, it kind of seems very simple, but it's very hard to do in practice, I think, for people. And a lot of it is based in fear. Would you agree?
I would. And I think the other thing I would say to that is that it's never going to stay static anyway.
Exactly.
So you can come up with the finest blueprint for what the world might look like. And, and you know, tomorrow it all gets torn up because something else happens. So the key to it all, I think, is agility. Mm-hmm. And this ability to allow experimentation. You know, if I look at, you know, my own business, how we operate, we try to do the right thing. If it's appropriate to have people working together in one location for a reason, we do it. Mm-hmm. If it isn't, we don't. I mean, I do remember post-pandemic saying to people, you know, the last thing I wanted was for them to be wasting, you know, 3 hours a day commuting. Mm-hmm. Made no sense.
Right.
You know, we perfected the art of remote working. That being said, if you actually need to get in a room with someone and
right.
brainstorm on a flip chart, then, you know,
then do it.
Do it.
Yeah.
And so allowing people, I think, to make the right call based mm-hmm. on what's needed at the time without mm-hmm. being constrained by some of these things. It is, I think, the real art mm-hmm. of the leader when it comes to that kind of creation of the environment But I think you're right. I think there is so much fear out there, the fear of getting it wrong, you know. And I suppose if we look at turnover rates, you know, I mean, I don't know what the life expectancy of a chief executive is in an organization. It's not that long.
No.
You know, nor is it for, say, a CMO, where CHROs tend to stay around a little bit longer.
Yeah.
But once you're at the C-suite, you know, you're not there for a great deal of time. And if you go into security, then I think it's down to something like 12 to 18 months, which is just crazy.
Yeah, I was just on a think tank call yesterday, and someone actually had that data around what the average tenure of a CEO was 10 or 20 years ago and what it is now. And it's definitely gone down. And I know, you know, from my proximity to CMOs, for example, that tenure, at least in tech, is approximately 18 months.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not a long time. And so again, you're constantly shifting. And this kind of leads me to a question, kind of an organic question here, is how do you balance that constant change and that need for experimentation from the vantage point of being able to manage security and risk? So if you've got your chief security officer, you've got your risk compliance officer, experimentation is not necessarily their friend all the time. So how do you balance that within a culture of being comfortable with experimentation and design thinking with keeping the organization locked down and safe?
Yeah, I mean, the last thing you wanted to do is have somebody who's sort of playing around with, let's try this security protocol today, and if it doesn't work, well, you know, we'll try a different one.
Exactly, exactly. Especially with a remote or a hybrid workforce, you know.
Well, exactly, exactly. No, I think that in that instance, you know, it comes down to more of a sort of philosophical discussion around what is the role of security. And for me, the role of security is to support the business to achieve its objectives in a safe manner, so that when things go wrong, the organization is sufficiently resilient that it doesn't suffer as badly as it would have done without you.
Right.
Now, that is a very different approach to security, I think, in terms of the definition of it. And I'm sure that, you know, some of our members listening to this will think I've lost the plot, but I do actually believe that's what it's becoming.
Yeah.
And I think successful CISOs get that. Mm-hmm. They get that they are there to support the business. They're not there to prevent the business doing things. They're there to provide advice, guidance, to consult with the business as to what might look, you know, good for them, and to understand the risk associated with some of the different elements that they're implementing. So, you know, I'll use myself as an example. So I travel a fair amount. I'm also targeted on a regular basis with phishing attacks and all of the things that most see. You know, it's not new news, is it?
Mm-hmm.
In order to manage and mitigate that risk, if I'm traveling, I don't have access to any of our sensitive corporate systems. I have my email, but that's it.
Right.
So I can't access the HR system or the, you know, payroll and all. I can't access payroll anyway. Actually, I don't need to. My FD does that. But so I've stripped back very deliberately what I can access as a means of managing my risk profile when I'm traveling to the extent that I do. Obviously, when I'm in the office, different matter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I had to change the way that I worked slightly to accommodate that, but it's a very effective and efficient way of working. What it also does, which I think is really good, is it means that other members of my team have to pick up certain things.
Right.
So I'm no longer this single point of failure.
Right.
And I like to think they like it because it means they can access it. You probably hate it, you know.
Distributed management, yes.
but by doing that, what you're also doing is introducing a higher degree of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
So people can see why things are happening or why we want to do what we're intending to do. Mm-hmm. And they've got firsthand experience of some of that. And so gradually as well, what that produces is a much flatter organization and a much broader opportunity for people to have sensible conversations about the importance of certain risk elements or indeed about the business as a whole.
Right.
And so you have more ideas as to how you might change, as to how you might be more effective. And so the benefits that you begin to see from a very simple decision that was taken because I was really actually fed up of every time I went to the US, my credit card was the details were stolen. You know, I don't know how much phishing, and it was always a particular part.
Yeah.
And so it was just brought about by mm-hmm. that. The benefits that we've seen as a result, I would never have anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we'd sat down in a room and tried to come up with them, it would have been a waste of time. So
right.
I think that again, just being open to introducing more agility, difference, change, trying something. You know, one of my biggest frustrations is that people don't try new things often enough.
Right.
Within a sandbox type environment. You
mm-hmm.
know,
you have to have guardrails. Yeah.
Of course.
Yes.
And so in security, I think there's an immense amount of opportunity for people to think differently in terms of raising levels of awareness. There's mm-hmm. also a need for some fairly locked down protocols, processes that are in line with standards, because that just makes a lot of sense.
Right.
You know? And I think that the trick from the CISO perspective running a security department is make sure you've got the right people doing the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And just to be able to communicate those.
And that, you know, that's what my work is all about, is that the old leadership paradigm is dying. And, you know, you made a point earlier about command and control. I've had several military leaders on this show mm-hmm. where they talk about command and control works in the heat of battle. We're not in the heat of battle 24/7 in an organization. Mm-hmm. So then it doesn't work. We need more collaborative. We need more partnering with versus powering over in order to get the best results. And so that example that you're talking about is really an idea of you've got to let go as a leader. You are not going to be able to control everything. You've got to be able to create a culture where you're empowering people to do their part. And you're collaborating, you're listening. We talked earlier about getting curious, but that kind of, you know, risk mitigation that you're talking about in that example doesn't happen if you're trying to hold everything close to you as a leader. We've got to be able to trust. We've got to be secure enough and confident enough in our own abilities that we know we're bringing in a team that will give us different perspectives, may challenge us on occasion because of the place where they sit and the vantage point that they have. So I love what you're saying, because that's a very practical example of where some leaders might have a hard time letting go of the control.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think, you know, again, back in that whole security space, you know, I'm a big fan of running cyber simulation exercises, business continuity planning, for want of a better description. You know, when an incident happens, that is not the time to be freestyling.
Exactly. That's the time. That might be the time for command and control. Yeah.
That is the time for command and control.
Yeah.
But when you are rehearsing, when you're going through a simulation exercise, that is the time for just playing with it a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. analyzing how did that go? How do we compare with other organizations? You know, mm-hmm. Is this what good really looks like? How did, you know, what went wrong? So I think that, again, creating the space for play, if mm-hmm. I could, has benefits, even if you're going to ultimately be in a command and control situation.
Right.
Don't want people to be fiddling about with things in that scenario. You don't have mm-hmm. the time. It's too, you know, high octane. It's too stressful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as we kind of wrap up, I wanted to ask you a question about navigating division in the workplace. So you kind of could look at division in the workplace as a risk, as a risk to the business, as a risk to it being fulfilling its mission, fulfilling its purpose, and serving its stakeholders. But where does navigating division in the workplace, does that fall under, for you, does that fall under the category of risk? Is that something that a risk officer or a CISO or somebody like that should even be concerned about? Or are they just concerned about technological risk and environmental risk?
I'm not sure that I understand what navigating division means, to be honest.
Okay, so navigating conflict and navigating maybe potentially culture rifts within your organization. For the example we were talking about earlier, if you've got a mutiny on your hands because of return to office policies, where those have actually been done intentionally and thoughtfully, let's say, and this fictitious scenario we're talking about.
Mm.
Is that actually something in the purview of a compliance officer, of a risk officer, or does that still sit squarely in HR?
I think it has to sit squarely in HR.
Okay. You know?
I mean, I think that there is also a bit of a tendency that we need to avoid of thinking that the higher you go in the organization, you have this ability to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're omniscient, omnipotent, and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I firmly believe that, you know, if, certainly again, if we look at my own organization, my CHRO is far better placed to deal with all of those sorts of things than I will ever be or mm-hmm. any of my other senior leadership team.
Mm-hmm. So,
however, I would not expect her to do the job of the CTO because the CTO is there to do that job. So I think it's about people understanding the lanes that they must stay within.
Right. Their zones of genius.
Their zones, exactly. That's a great way of describing it.
Yeah.
And also understanding that by cross-communicating,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be better than mm-hmm. just handing down these sort of edicts as to how we should mm-hmm. do things. Some of the things that drive me crazy, you know, is when people implement bits of technology and they don't explain why. I'm a big sort of why thing. I've always
I love it.
Been my thing it. Right from when I was a child. You know, I always probably don't know why I should do something. And
you and every other child in the world. Yes, absolutely.
And it's just sort of stayed with me. And I think that you can solve so many problems by explaining things better at the beginning and getting the right people involved who actually know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Who are being, you know, paid to do that job rather than somebody coming up with a better idea. And this applies to business with security and security with business as well. It's throughout, it permeates the organization.
Would you go so far as to say that having a CEO who doesn't think that way is a risk to the organization?
I think it is today.
Yeah.
I think it is today. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that they don't exist. I mean, there are mm-hmm. plenty of them out there.
I mean, we could look at many examples. Yes.
Exactly. But I think if you're going to endure, if you're going to be successful, you know, we touched on earlier the fact that CEOs don't stay around for very long. So from a board standpoint, you know, there's always a risk when you hire a new CEO that you can do all of the diligence until the person hits the ground. You're never going to know whether they're going to make it or not.
Mm-hmm.
If they make it, you want to try to keep them for as long as possible. And I think that the ones that will endure in the future will have this ability to be much more flexible, agile, call it what you will, have a much broader perspective than perhaps some of the more traditional ones that we've still got in place. And the challenge, I think, there is it's just something else that we're expecting the CEO to do mm-hmm. in addition. Managing the shareholders, you know, mm-hmm. the stock price and, you know, all of those sorts of things. And, you know, I don't want to come across as some sort of bleeding heart, but it's a pretty lonely old job
mm-hmm.
as well. You know, there are not many people who really want to. There are lots of people who really think they would want to be it. You know, yeah, I want to be CEO, fantastic. But actually, it's probably, you know, one of the most lonely jobs.
Yes.
When it's going well, fantastic.
Yeah.
When it isn't, then, you know, you're on your own.
Right.
And,
right. Well, that's why many of the successful CEOs I've spoken to and advised, they are part of accountability circles. They're part of peer support groups. They're part of, you know, places and spaces where they can feel less lonely and also sanity check themselves. So, and they're the ones that tend to be more empathetic and agile CEOs because they know I don't have all the answers. You wouldn't be going to an accountability group or a support group or a peer group if you thought you had all the answers. You'd think you wouldn't need it. So the ones that I find are most successful and they're balancing that performance, that high performance with empathetic and people-centered leadership are the ones who are willing to put their ego aside and say, I still always have more to learn. And that's how they also feel less lonely, to your point, is they try to surround themselves with other people that can help them grow and help them learn.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you have to have people around you who are not afraid to challenge,
mm-hmm.
From whom you can grow, you can pick up different things. And, you know, I think in every interaction, there are things that you can learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, my favorite is actually spending time with some of the much, you know, graduates and things that might join us because mm-hmm. they're great perspective. They're totally unencumbered
right.
by corporate politics and nonsense. And they just call it as it is, you know, and they've got great ideas.
Yeah.
And so I love being able to try to create space for some of that and just let them try it. You know? Mm-hmm.
I love that. Well, this has been such a great conversation, Steve. Thank you so much for your insights and for really helping us understand. You know, what I'm taking away from this is actually it is a risk to your organization if your leadership can't be agile and can't be people focused. Like that's sort of one of my headline takeaways from today. So thank you so much. We are going to have all your links in the show notes for folks, but for anyone on the go right now, where's the best place they can find out more about you and your work?
Oh, the easiest one is obviously LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. People can find me on that. Specifically around what I do, what the ISF does, then again, if they go along to our website, which is mm-hmm. Securityforum.org, mm-hmm. then all of my details are there.
And, fantastic.
Contact me either way.
Great. Securityforum.org. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It was a pleasure to connect.
No, nice talking to you, Maria.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of the Empathy Edge podcast. If you like what you heard, you know what to do. Please rate and review and share it with a friend or a colleague. And until next time, please remember that cash flow, creativity, and compassion are not mutually exclusive. Take care and be kind. For more on how to achieve radical success through empathy, visit theempathyedge.com. There you can listen to past episodes, access show notes and free resources, book me for a keynote or workshop, and sign up for our email list to get new episodes, insights, news, and events. Please follow me on Instagram at RedSliceMaria. Never forget, empathy is your superpower. Use it to make your work and the world a better place.